Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another edition of the Daily French Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, and I'm joined today by Mr. Herman Pretorius. Herman, how are you?
Well, we have scheduled to talk about UK politics. It's almost a sort of romantic atmosphere for me here today.
Yes, we'll get to that at the end. And we are also joined by the great son of Benoni, Mr. Maurice Root. Maurice, how are you?
How's it, Nick? How's it, Herman? I don't want to ever imagine Herman in a romantic situation ever again. So,
ever again. I'm glad you keep that one clean up.
Anyway, so let's get started with, rather than talking about South Africa like we usually do, we're going to go a little bit further afield to a country that does its best to kind of not be on anyone's minds ever. I don't think many people know that there is a Belarus, and those that do probably have at least a little bit of a difficult time pointing it out on a map. And yet, it is in the news.
Yeah,
so what happened was...
It's the fourth B country. You've got Brazil, Belgium, Botswana, and then... and that's where we are.
Exactly. So what happened? Well, a plane was flying between Greece and Lithuania. And as the plane passed over Belarusian airspace, the Belarusian air traffic control contacted the plane to say they had received information that there was a bomb on board and that the plane needed to land immediately. Before the pilot of the plane could perhaps make a decision for themselves about where and when they were going to land, a Belarusian Air Force fighter jet arrived on the scene to escort the plane to the airport. Upon landing, Belarusian police in large numbers entered the plane, searched it for a bomb, and upon clearing it, said that the plane could take off again. However, they found someone on the plane who was of interest to them, and they took him and his girlfriend off into custody just before they let the plane go. That person is, of course, a 26-year-old activist and journalist who has been big on the Telegram messaging app and has done a lot of stuff to expose the problems with the regime of the Belarusian dictator, Alexander Lukashenko. This journalist, I can't remember his name, I think it's Prayatsevich, something like that, was known to be on the plane by the Belarusian authorities. And essentially what seems to have happened here is that, using the excuse of a bomb, they kidnapped him. He was then shown later on Belarusian state TV admitting to various crimes, such as organizing anti-government protests. And he had appeared in the video as though he had received severe beatings and physical injury while he was in custody. So this looks like some pretty... his name is Roman Pratsevich, I think. He was living in exile in Lithuania and had actually gone to Greece for a conference at the time. So that's why he was flying back to Lithuania from that conference. It seems to me that this is a pretty brazen kidnapping, and it seems almost like an act of... It's like something a swashbuckling pirate might do. You know, you'd expect this kind of thing sort of out of North Korea, rather than some country on the edges of Europe. The European Union immediately agreed last night, in what is an unusually fast move for the European Union, which tends to take its time in doing everything, to impose severe sanctions on Belarus and banning any European Union airlines from flying through Belarusian airspace from this point forward. So what should we make of this? Herman, your thoughts on this rather bizarre case? Is this the sign? Is this going to be a new tactic that rogue regimes might start trying around the world?
Well, I think so. I mean, it's always dangerous when one considers history to see schools of thought and periods and dominated areas or thought and so on. But I am very, very tempted to look at that this global geopolitical circumstance change, even over the last 10 years, as the early ringing bells or the overture for a new geopolitical settlement, as it were. Because, I mean, if we look through the 20th century and we perhaps take it back to the post-war consensus after the Second World War, that became the Cold War. And that really bled into the booming 90s in a way, with Bill Clinton and Tony Blair sort of leading the charge for center-left liberalism. And the end of a century of a lot of bloodshed and strain, and then that period being brought to a jarring end by 9/11 and the war on terror. And I think then you look at a period between the war on terror being the dominant thing to the financial crash, and then from the financial crash to COVID, you've got another definite, you know, dominant period of thinking with some identifiable strains. And I can't help but think that a world order, not in the, you know, sort of way, but that the world order is resetting in a certain way. Norms are changing. The behavior of actors on the international stage is changing. I wouldn't be surprised if this is a flow out from the killing of the appetite for war, which I think you can see very much in the Iraq war. Emasculated stuff, entities like NATO, really, really blighting the appetite for having that option for armed conflict open as a regulator on the global stage. So that appetite being killed, the unpopularity of those in power financially and politically in the financial crash and then the last 10 years with COVID, I think it has removed the escalation room that for much of world history was there, that you toe the line because there are powers willing to bomb you. And I think the fact that there are powers willing to bomb you, that threat no longer holds as much water as it once did, is stimulating a new approach to international affairs and perhaps some rogue actions by states like this.
So one of the interesting things about this is, of course, Belarus is very close to Vladimir Putin's Russia. The Russian government, I think, has significant stakes in the Belarusian economy, and it's often thought of as basically a protectorate or a vassal state of Russia. That basically it's an unofficial extension of the Russian state in a lot of ways. There have even been talks occasionally of unifying Belarus and Russia into one country again, although Lukashenko has played a lot of games on this front, so it's not entirely clear how serious those talks are. But it's quite interesting. So it really does seem like Russia and its ally are getting a lot more bold. And I think the world is now being set up for a sort of conflict where you might see something like a global conflict with Russia seizing territory perhaps from its neighbors in the Baltic states or in Ukraine. At the same time, in coordination with a Chinese invasion of Taiwan, which, of course, China has long expressed a desire to do.
Nick, if I could quickly jump in here, something that we should also consider is Hong Kong, the Hong Kong situation, and how the Western world has either reacted or not reacted to it, again, sort of easing in a period of bad actor appeasement that might motivate people like, you know, these Lukashenko and Putin and so on, to be more bold and challenging what might have once considered Western liberal democratic norms of international order.
Right. So there's definitely a storm brewing on the international front, I think. Maurice, I want your thoughts on this. And also, let me posit a scenario to you. A lot of air traffic goes through Qatar and the United Arab Emirates in the Middle East. But a lot of those flights have to go over countries that are, shall we say, a little bit unstable or a little bit roguish. I'm thinking Syria, I'm thinking Iran, I'm thinking Iraq, I'm thinking Yemen, I'm thinking parts of Saudi Arabia. I can see very much maybe someone in one of those areas getting the bright idea that maybe they too can repeat this kind of action, take hostages, take prisoners. What do you think the effects of this kind of tactic might be for the world? And what are your thoughts generally?
I think it's important to point out that Belarus is not a member of the International Air Services Transit Agreement. I know this because I did 2 months of research before the show. So and that means they're not members of what they call the first freedom. There's a concept called the first freedom of the air, which basically means countries can fly over wherever and not be forced to land. But Belarus is not a member of this agreement. So they were, obviously, I mean, this is pretty much actions of of pirate states or rogue states, as you were saying earlier. So I think I would imagine most of those countries in the Middle East, especially places that are more in part of the global economy, such as Saudi Arabia and Qatar and the UAE and so on, I think it's probably quite likely that they're also members of this agreement. So I doubt we'll see.
So let me clarify. I'm not saying necessarily their governments might do something, but that, you know, I don't know, someone with an anti-aircraft missile will say to a plane, "Hey guys, you better land, or else something might happen to your plane."
But I think that's been happening already, hasn't it? I mean, we saw that Malaysian airline get shot at the sky. I think it was in 2014, was it? Anyway, overflying over the Ukraine. So I mean, this kind of thing, and also generally speaking, your rebel groups don't really have missiles that can reach up 30,000 feet. All of the cases, of course, some of them.
Well, Iran, remember, Iran shot down a passenger plane relatively recently by mistake.
Yeah. I think relatively, I think it was the 80s. So, I mean, or if we're saying.
No, they did.
Was it 2010 about, I think?
No, it was 2019.
Really?
After, yeah, sorry, 2020. It was after the killing of Soleimani.
Yes, you're right. Yes.
Yes. But, it's strange. Everyone's forgotten that, but it was a big deal at the time.
But I think also some will argue that Iran is already something of a rogue state. So, and they already kind of don't follow global norms and so on. I mean, you know, the issues with nuclear bombs or developing nuclear weaponry. But I think this is all part of what Harriman was saying, kind of a change in global norms. And we've seen that Francis Fukuyama's end of history thesis that liberal democracy was like human's final form of government has obviously been shown to be quite incorrect, even though he does admit that. And we've seen a lot of dictators around the world become more bold. You know, I think Xi Jinping is a special case, but would he have, if under Hu Jintao or Deng Xiaoping, whoever, would they be doing to the Uyghurs what they're doing now if, you know, under a different kind of global environment, whatever the case is? And this isn't just happening in China, or we've seen India as well. You know, Narendra Modi and his BJP have been doing some very dodgy things in India too. It's the Belarusians, as you mentioned. It's also Ethiopia. Seems to be there's an actual genocide happening in northeast Ethiopia at the moment, which not many people seem to be too concerned about. And the West also seems to be turning something of a blind eye to. So I think, it's a lot of countries have got already a lot of their plates with COVID and the resulting economic crisis that has come from it. Although we're seeing, it seems to be a good economic bounce back in some places because they're managing to open up and so on. But I mean, yeah, who knows when we'll get to that in South Africa. So, yeah, I mean, no, I don't see this kind of becoming a thing that's going to become much more common. But I think Belarus has probably been emboldened by Vladimir Putin. And also he's been pretty much being able to do whatever he wants in Eastern Europe. So that's probably part of it. If Vladimir Putin had been smacked on the nose with a rolled up newspaper, as he should have been a couple of years ago, but that didn't happen. So I think that's emboldened Putin and by extension, Lukashenko as well.
Nick, I want to spend too much time on this, but I do think, ironically, that is why Trump was something good on the international stage, because he was unpredictable or perceived to be unpredictable. And, you know, that he was this presence of Damocles that he might just be mad enough to unleash the fury of the United States Army for all its ills, still an immense fighting force. The fact that you have more predictability in the White House, more predictability from America, and not that sort of fear that Reagan and Trump engendered in their opponents that these cowboys might just go the full hog and take you down. I do think that is ironically a destabilizing factor on the global stage.
I think there is definitely, I think that the problem goes deeper than any one leader or Western administration. I think generally speaking, the free societies around the world, so in Europe, America, Asia, like countries like Japan and stuff, a lot of them, less so in Japan, but a lot of them become very inwardly focused. There's a lot of internal cultural battles and deep political divides. You can see that over Brexit in the UK. You can see that in the culture wars in America. And, you know, in such a space where those countries really don't care about what's going on outside their borders, the more aggressive authoritarian regimes of the world are looking around and saying, maybe we can realign the world order in our favor. Mm. And that is a recipe for a much bigger conflict, I think, in years to come. Anyway, let us not dwell too much on such hefty and weighty topics, and let us instead return to South Africa to talk about what I would say South Africa's most famous cartoonist, Zapiro, who has recently drawn a cartoon that really got up, I think, all of our noses, but especially Herman's nose. Herman, can you just describe the cartoon to us very briefly, and then we can have a good whinge about it.
I think I can do better than that. So what everyone can see there is essentially it's Helen Zille and Dom Steiner is portrayed as a band on a stage, and Pumzile van Dam walking off, and Dom Steiner is saying to her, "But Pumzile, you're our top backing vocalist." And she says, "Well, exactly." And then she walks through a door saying, "Credible black leaders exit." And the thing that really sort of just got me there was the fact that on Helen is the percussionist in this, and it's on the big bass drum thingy there's the DA average white band. Now you don't have to be terribly clever to see average white band stands for Avia Beer, and that is this obvious narrativizing piece of cartoon art that plays into two narratives so lazily. One, that the DA has somehow shifted its focus to become a white party and just secure its vote, and two, that there's been this mass exodus of credible black leaders. And Marius, as you pointed out, if you think Pumzile van Dam is a credible black leader, I mean, you really have to consider taking the vaccine of some sort, or just, you know, drinking less.
Marius, What are your thoughts on this? How do you feel about this cartoon? Is Herman right? It's been portrayed that Pumzile was a great loss for the DA. Do you think that's true?
Look, I mean, I was blocked on Twitter a couple of years ago by Pumzile when I pointed out the fact that she doxed a private individual on Twitter. And if you search the person's name, the tweet from Pumzile was an account called Sal Nomics, who the real person behind it tragically committed suicide a few years ago. I think it was about 2 years ago. But she accused somebody else of being behind this account. And that's pretty much doxing. When I pointed that out to her, she blocked me. And I've seen her behavior on Twitter is not something that you want to... we can talk about a number of other politicians that also maybe shouldn't be on Twitter so much. But her behavior does make you think it's... that she didn't really show much gravitas with her behavior on Twitter. But that said, I think it's always important to... give credit where credit's due. And from what I've read from others, Nikki might be able to have more insights about this. She seems to have been a fairly hardworking, dedicated MP. I can see Herman's face. I see Nick's shaking his head, but then I'll move on swiftly. But then I'll just make the other points I'll make. Her statement saying she was resigning as an MP, I thought it was a very measured statement, and it was quite dignified, and it was far better, I thought, than what, for example, Musima Amani. He behaved when he resigned as leader of the DA. He threw his toys, and I really lost a lot of respect for Musima Amani when he did that. And I've said, I think Pumzile van Dam's statement was a very measured statement. It was somebody who's got a measured and dignified statement, and I think we have to give her kudos for that. And she didn't say the DA is a massively racist party, blah, blah, blah. She said she's remaining as a member. So I think we do have to give her kudos for that, I think.
Yeah, I'd mostly agree with that thought in the statement. I mean, she did say on Twitter that there was vaguely that there was an evil cabal of people who are making life impossible and something like that, which is, I would say not terribly professional, but whatever, that's her choice to say that. It's obviously how she felt. And I do think that, there were a lot of incentives for her to do something very nasty to the party. And so it's interesting that she didn't do that, and I think it's a good thing that she didn't do that. I think it shows
at least
with that. But can I just say, yeah, go on, Homer.
At least in her case, her resignation wasn't the first time the public paid attention to her, other than what was it, Moody in Gauteng here. If your resignation is your moment to shine, then I mean it really is a testament to a wasted political career. And for all her ills, Pumzile van Dam won't have that slapped on her.
But as for her political career, I must say that the couple of times she did manage to get something like ideas or legislation into the public eye, there were things that I really didn't think were particularly good. I mean, I think she had the communications portfolio, I think I'm correct in saying. And there was stuff like, the rights to rugby must be given to the SABC and stuff like that.
Regulating social media and free speech.
Yeah, regulating social media, wanting to have social media controls like they have overseas. So I don't think she was particularly liberal in her beliefs about free speech. I think that there was, from my perspective, it looks a lot like I think she spent a lot more time cultivating a sort of online personality rather than doing sort of legislative work. But ultimately, history and the voters shall be the judge. So we shall see.
I think it is worth pointing out that you're only a black leader in the DA once you're leaving it. If you're in the DA, you're a black puppet. If you're leaving the DA, you're a black leader. At least, from the perception of many in traditional news media and the dominating media houses in South Africa. And now one of the best things that the DA can do, and I think I'm picking up them doing that, is stop courting news media. It was so telling that Musi Maimane became the darling of the media once he was no longer leader of the DA. The bias here is just so blatant and so obvious. And I'm not a great cheerleader for the DA myself, although I might now consider voting for them now that Bonzile Fandam is no longer an MP and I cannot reasonably be seen to have contributed to her getting a seat in Parliament. But the toxicity here, and the racialized toxicity, where if you're a black person, you're in the DA, you're a puppet. But if you leave, you're a credible black leader. I think the DA should call that nonsense out or ignore it. I think the ordinary people are much, much more attuned to what matters in this country. So I must say, I think the DA is shifting.
I think it is very interesting that someone like Pumzile, journalists would always seek her comment on anything that could be seen as a racially divisive issue. And the question always seemed to be asked, what do you as a black leader in the DA think, knowing that she would be fairly critical of the party because she was fairly critical and is fairly critical of the DA. But someone like Rafiwa Ntseke, who is actually, I think, more senior in the party structures than Pumzile, who is not aggressively critical of the party, never gets attention from the media. Just like she doesn't
Wrong kind of black lady.
Right, exactly.
And we can go on about this for hours and hours, but one thing I would sound just a warning on is the DA sort of made their bed here a bit over the last 10, 15 years in starting to play the, we need black support, let's boost black leaders game, which I hope they are now revising, because the nonsense idea that if you appoint on merit, you exclude black people, assumes black people don't have merit. So I must say, I think it seems that they're moving beyond that. Someone like Rafiloe is, to my mind, an immensely impressive politician who deserves her position, not because he's black or a woman, but because she's just bloody good at her job. So the DA has some guilt here in laying the groundwork for this kind of identitarianism that we are now criticizing.
Anyway, let us move on once again to overseas. And we're going to struggle to fit this into the last 5 minutes that we have here, because I know Herman has a lot to say on this topic. But we haven't been back to look at UK politics that recently. I think the last time we talked about it was just before the Scottish and local government elections in the UK. And it looks like, as far as I can tell, the Scottish Nationalists did well. Mm-hmm. Did very badly, losing another seat in what used to be its heartland in the north of the country to the Conservatives. And there's now the fighting within the Labour Party seems to be renewed, as its leader Keir Starmer seems to be more aggressively purging opponents from the other faction in the party, the sort of more farther left faction. Herman, am I right about that? And what are your thoughts on UK politics?
Yeah, broadly speaking, I'll keep my remarks to a minimum, because Marius really has wonderful things to add here. Number one, the Scottish Nationalists did well, but not well enough to achieve an overall majority in the Holyrood Parliament. So they will demand a second referendum, but their mandate for doing so is much weaker.
Well, I will say that pro-independence parties do hold a majority, because even though the Scottish Nationalists don't have a majority, the Scottish Greens are pro-independence and they hold a majority.
It's interesting because the Holyrood Parliament consists of proportional and constituency seats. And on the proportional, it's interesting, unionist parties got more votes, but on the ward seats, separatists got more votes. So the thing in Scotland, the situation in Scotland is quite in flux, not as clearly strongly unionist as the union might have wanted to be, but also not as clear-cut as the SNP wanted to be. Had they gotten their own majority, they would have obviously gone for an independence referendum sooner rather than later. Then, briefly, south of the border, Keir Starmer is in an impossible position. I think they just lost Hartlepool in a by-election. Hartlepool is a seat that was Labour for decades. I think you can take it back to the 1920s. And it is part of that so-called Red Wall. And the thing
I think the seat was formed in the 70s. So it's been Labour every single year since the 70s.
Okay, I think I'm thinking of Blythe Valley. The point is that the Red Wall, and with this I'll hand over to Maurice, the Red Wall that Boris Johnson built, presumably around Get Brexit Done in 2019, seems to be intact for the Tories. And that is a very, very interesting clue as to where you go left and right on which issues and where you occupy the center ground.
Maurice, your thoughts?
Yeah, I think Harriman's spot on there. And if Labour's not careful, they're going to struggle to win an election for another 10 or 20 years. As it is, the last time Labour won an election with the leader who wasn't called Blair was 47 years ago. So the Labour Party has its work cut out. And I think it's going to probably struggle in this upcoming by-election in Batley and Spen. We could see the Tories take that as well. But I think what it shows, and I think this is, we even saw this kind of glimmering of this actually in the US as well. Parties that lean left economically and slightly right on social issues will tend to do quite well, because the Tories are definitely not right-wing on economic issues anymore. They've been spending a lot of money. I mean, I think it's the highest deficits, I'm not sure if it's in history, but certainly as high as once since the Second World War. And while they're not right-wing on social issues, they definitely stand against wokeness, for example. I mean, they're actually fairly liberal. I mean, you know, gay marriage is allowed in the UK, and there's no real argument in that with the Tories, you know, except for, you know,
brought in by the Conservative Party.
Exactly. Yeah. So overall, they're pretty. I mean, so I think that, you know, if they kind of right wing in terms of wokeness and kind of left in on economic issues, I think they'll do pretty well. And that's what we're seeing. What's happening with the Tories? They did pretty well, all things considered, in the the local government elections, as you said, they won in Hartlepool. They were the second biggest party in the Scottish Parliament. So I think Labour's got his work cut out for it. I like Keir Starmer. I think he's better than Jeremy Corbyn. But there seems to be a lot of infighting, and I think he got a bit of a hospital pass from Corbyn Labour. So I think he's got his work cut out for him to see if he can actually get Labour to challenge the Tories the next election. As it stands now, I wouldn't want to be, I'd rather be Boris Johnson than Keir Starmer, but a week's a long time in politics, and it's probably 3 years till the next election in the UK. So yeah, that's even longer, so a lot can still happen.
Well said. And Herman, I'm going to give you only 30 seconds to respond to this, but is there a possibility that in the next couple of decades or even next couple of years, we'll see Labour sort of torn apart and replaced by a new woker, more middle-class party, I don't know, like the Greens, as the voice of the left, while the Conservatives consolidate a more sort of centrist, centre-right position?
I would recommend anyone curious about this question to look at the work of Matthew Goodwin, a pollster in the UK, where he essentially makes the point that you now have this tension between social identity and economic identity, and that the left, the Labour Party, could long straddle two camps that were close enough to each other, but you are now moving in the direction where these two things diverge, and that will, I think, fundamentally destroy the possibility of a Labour government ever again, but I might be overly brave in saying that.
Yes, I think that is probably a bit brave. Anyway, thank you very much to both of you, and we shall see what happens. Thank you very much for listening. We hope you enjoyed the show. Hope you found it interesting. Please like, subscribe, comment, all that good stuff. And if you want to support the IRR and the Daily Friend, SMS your name to 32823 on the banners behind me and Herman. You can see it there. If you SMS your name, we'll call you back and sign you up to become a friend of the Institute. Thank you very much for listening, and we'll see you tomorrow.